Hey, guys.
My, how time flies. Here it is already, Monday morning again. Time for more shows. Well, time for this show, and then, you know, same time tomorrow for another show, just like it, only different. Hope you had a good weekend. Mine was pretty good. Yeah, thanks. I got some work done. I spend all week looking forward to the weekend, because then I can really get some work done, finally. I know, I'm kind of a kook that way, but it worked out. I actually got some things out of the way, I think. I'm actually waiting to hear back still. All right, well, anyway. Hey, guys. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm him. My website is scotthorton.org. Here's what you do, if you want. Go to scotthorton.org/chat and join up the chat room and hang out with the boys and girls. Hey, everybody. How's it going? Good to see you. It's an IRC Freenode chat, so it's hashtag Scott Horton Show if you like using external chat applications like Chatzilla or Pigeon or XChat. Those are the three that I know. But also, you can just go to a plain old browser window in Exploder, Mozilla, or Chrome, or Opera, or Safari. Those are all of those that I know. And just go to scotthorton.org/chat, put in a fake name and a caption, you're in. You could even use your real name if you're interested in doing that. And then you can hang out during the show. Make some comments. Ask some questions. All right. Also, I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Follow me there. Retweet me. Let people know that there's a show on today. And there is. We're going to have Avner. Oops. I better spell that right on my page. Avner. Oh, man. Why does everybody always do this to me? Gavaryahu. Gavaryahu. Right? Say it fast. Gavaryahu. Gavaryahu. Now, that's probably wrong. But I'm going to try it, and I hope to remember to ask him how to pronounce it. Gavaryahu. Avner Gavaryahu. He's from a group in Israel called Breaking the Silence, and they've just published this massive thing. As far as I can tell, it's simply testimonies of IDF soldiers come forward to talk about what they did last year in the war on Gaza. I'm pretty sure that's it. As far as I can tell, I don't even see it. So, in summation, here's what we've learned, or anything. It's just testimonies. No, maybe that's not right. I guess there is other stuff. But mostly it's just testimonies, Winter Soldier type testimonies from the IDF. It's funny, I had a Hasbara troll in my Twitter feed this morning. Yeah, you picked a bad day to talk about poor little Israel. To me, pal. Breaking the Silence, Protective Edge Soldiers Testimonies from Gaza. Not for kids under, say, I don't know, 9 or something, probably. And then also, Patrick L. Smith. Now, the thing about that is, I recorded him on Saturday, and then I thought I was going to play it on Sunday morning on KPFK, but they have this thing where during Fun Drive, they play a full hour of Alan Watt, whoever that is, talking about Buddhism, which I guess is really interesting if you're a Buddhist. Not so much if you're not. But anyway, I guess it's more interesting than foreign policy stuff on a Sunday morning. So whenever it's their Fun Drive, they play him for an hour instead of me. So even though I sent in a show, they played this guy Alan Watt teaching people how to stare at a wall and say, until they reach enlightenment. Instead of my awesome interview of Patrick L. Smith about American policy in Ukraine and toward Russia. Kind of the same thing. So I'm going to play that for you on the show today. Because it's not fair to Patrick L. Smith. I took up a significant portion of his Saturday morning to record this interview and then didn't get played in L.A. like I told him it would. Which was kind of the deal when I asked him to be on the show. So try to make it up to him a little bit. by playing it on this show today. It was a great interview. And now I really regret that I had to cut out, you know, a bunch of it to make it short enough. Because I always record, you know me, I always go over time. So I gotta cut out. Actually, it's probably a good thing because I cut out mostly me and left him. So, anyway. Patrick L. Smith. What time is it? Okay, I got a couple of minutes to bring up the big news. Did you see the big news? Seymour Hersh came out with an article called The Killing of Osama Bin Laden. And already all the Vox types are claiming to debunk it. Although, as far as I can tell, they haven't laid a hand on him at all yet. But so there are major revelations. And man, I really should have taken notes the whole time I was reading the article, because what that means is when I have Hersh on tomorrow, the next day, or whenever I finally convince him to do the show, he wanted to see about the reaction first. Give me a day, he said. He did CNN, but apparently he did not do Amy Goodman. He told me he wasn't doing Amy Goodman anyway. I said, okay, fine, do Amy Goodman first, but then I got second dibs after her, crying out loud. And he said, no, I told her the same thing, man. I want to see what happens first. So, I don't know if he did her show. I'm looking now. I got Hersh on here? Hey, doesn't look like it. Okay, so I'm going to have Hersh on to talk about this thing. I should have taken extensive notes in the first place. Now I'm just going to have to go through and reread the whole damn thing again. But there are some major points in here that I'm pretty sure I can think of most of them off the top of my head that are the pretty important points for going over. I still have a couple of minutes to get us started anyway. And I'll tell you what, I'll frame it like this. You guys have heard me say on the show before. In fact, I said during an interview that I did where they interviewed me a couple of weeks ago, they asked me at the end of the interview, what about the killing of Bin Laden? It seemed like a big hoax kind of thing. And I said, well, you know, I have a lucky cheat sheet. You know, I'm in a situation that most people aren't in. I'm married to an investigative reporter and one with serious national security chops. And when Obama announced the killing of Osama, she got on the phone and she verified it immediately with multiple sources. And what she verified was that there was no firefight. That's one of the major pieces of Seymour Hersh's article here today. She told me that night, the same night he was killed, she told me that there was no firefight. She had that firsthand from intelligence sources. I think I've already said, so I hope it's okay to say, that at least one of whom was in Pakistan at the time. And so I knew that much. When they said, oh yeah, he hid behind his wife and he shot his AK-47 or he tried to or this and that and all that kind of thing, I already knew all that was not true at the time. So that's one point. And then the other thing is something that I haven't said on the show before, because it's like, and I'm no good at keeping secrets. I hate this, not saying this. But Larissa wrote a story right after this happened, and she had very good sources and multiple sources. And the story that she was going to break was, one, that there was no firefight. They basically walked right in there and shot him and killed him. Two, that the Pakistanis were in on it. The General Kiani of the military and, oh, what's his name from the intelligence services, that they had worked with the Americans on this, of course, including turning off the electricity in Abbottabad that night and, you know, helping keep the townspeople back and that kind of thing, guarantee security for the operation when it happened. And also, as Hersh reports as well, and all that is in this new Hersh story, also that the Saudis had been paying the Pakistanis to keep him safe there in Abbottabad, that he was under the protection of the ISI, and the Saudis were paying him to keep it that way. And the story got spiked. And then, well, it's kind of a complicated story I shouldn't tell about why it never got published. But anyway, I can verify myself that much of this because the wife reported it. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people.
The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 25th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee.
darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
All right, guys, welcome back.
Yeah, in the chat room, the question is, well, what about all the stories that bin Laden had died long ago or had already been captured long ago or this or that? I think, you know, there were always a lot of rumors of that. And in fact, you know, I remember seeing Bob Baer, the former CIA officer and CNN consultant guy on TV, saying that he thought he was dead, but that he knows other CIA current and former that they argued still about, and this was, you know, as late as 2010 or 11 or something like that, that they argued still among themselves whether they thought he was alive or dead or not. So there was a lot of speculation about that. But so my wife, she verified to her satisfaction, and she's an investigative reporter, and I'm taking her reporting's word for it myself, that, you know, you can, if you're not familiar, you can look up Larissa Alexandrovna at Raw Story and see all of the incredible stories that she broke back then in those years and see how well you think they stand up. I think they're just fine. And so she verified that, yes, he was killed there that night by the SEALs and this and that. And then, as I'm now saying for the first time on the show today, she had a story that had it where the Saudis had been paying the Pakistanis to keep him, but then at the end, the Pakistanis gave him over to the Americans and helped with the entire thing, which you might remember was contrary to the myth at the time that there had been a big battle and all these heroics and all this kind of stuff. Now, I'm pretty sure that was as far as she got with the story, and that was going to be, you know, kind of part one of it. And then the story got spiked by Raw Story, and they never ran it for reasons that are ridiculous, but I won't go into them because it's not really the point. And then for personal reasons, she basically just, that was the last article she wrote as far as investigative journalism goes. And so that was it. But now, so Hirsch has basically reported, oh, and I should also mention that, where the hell did it go? Okay, so there's a lady named R.J. Hillhouse. R.J. Hillhouse has this blog called The Spy Who Billed Me. And she came out with this in August of 2011. And her story, she had, and I don't think Larissa's story went into this, but this lady had it where an informant walked right in and gave up bin Laden. They didn't track him through the courier, much less through torture to get the courier's name. She's had that, and then she also had ISI was keeping him there, that they cooperated on the raid, and the Saudis were paying to keep him there. So she had this lady, R.J. Hillhouse, she had Larissa's entire story. I mean, not, it's a short kind of blog entry. It's not the full fleshed out story with, because Larissa had about them turning off the electricity and everything, just like in Hirsch's story. So this, it's not quite as developed. But as far as the major points, this lady Hillhouse had that story as early as August 7th, 2011. So that's something. And then, but now so Hirsch, he comes and verifies all of that. Says they basically just walked right in and took him. He even has it where they were basically led by an ISI agent into the place. He also has it that the... don't let me forget to get to the Vinson in a second, the so-called burial at sea, which I don't think anybody ever really bought. But get this.
And there's a write-up. Jason Ditz has a write-up about this at antiwar.com today. CIA's fake vaccination program in Pakistan, unrelated to bin Laden's officials' term scheme, a cynical hoax. Okay? So now, remember this scandal. The Americans, by using this vaccination campaign, this polio vaccination campaign, in order to get bin Laden family DNA to verify he was there, had discredited the vaccination campaign and it led to an increase in polio in Pakistan. Remember that? Giant tragedy. Oh, well, had to do it to get bin Laden, so tough titty, right? Well, check this out. It turns out they had a doctor who ISI put there, and it was his job to verify bin Laden through DNA, and he never did get the chance to do it, but they went ahead anyway because they knew it was him anyway. And only later did they come up with blaming the vaccine doctor as the cover story. Just as part of their lie, they put it on the vaccine doctor and discredited the vaccine program just to try to weave a tale. So, man, isn't that something? Go read Jason Ditz about that. And then, okay, so let's see. What else has got here? He says that the SEALs, whenever they shop bin Laden, apparently they just machine gun the crap out of them. I don't know. M4s, or what kind of rifles do the SEALs carry? They don't carry M4s, right? They have bigger barrel guns than that. Anyway, apparently they blasted them up real good. And then the deal was, there was supposed to be, the cover story was that they got him in a drone strike and found out, yay, we got him with a DNA test after the fact. But then because of the helicopter crash, which they were not going to be able to cover up, Obama decided to go out and spike the football and go on TV and say that we got him. So then at that point, they started coming up with all these kind of ad hoc lies to try to, you know, weave the tale. And part of that was the so-called burial at sea, where the real story is, according to Hirsch, the last people seen with the body was the CIA. That's it. That's where the story of what happened to his body ends. I don't want to get too far off into speculation there, but I bet you know what I think. But, yeah, I mean, and there were stories from the beginning. I mean, the tales of the burial at sea weren't really believable in the beginning. And there were reports, weren't there reports that came out kind of right away of people on that boat saying, man, that never happened. We would have at least known about it. You know what I mean? Everybody would have. Hey, did you hear Osama's corpse is on board and they're throwing it overboard? Yeah, man. You're telling me that wouldn't get around if that really happened? Give me a break. So, yeah, anyway. I don't think did anybody ever really believe the burial at sea thing? No, I don't think so. So Hirsch has that. So basically, a big part of the story here is about the Pakistanis working with us. And he says that Obama and you know, Justin Raimondo and a couple others, Larissa, noted that, yeah, Obama in his initial statement said the Pakistanis helped us with this. But then, according to Hirsch, no, man, you weren't supposed to say that. And they decided instead to basically stage a big rift and pretend that General Kiani and what's his name, the head of their intelligence services there, had not been in on the raid for various political reasons, including that they had double-crossed the Saudis and double-crossed Al-Qaeda. But, gotta go. Back in a minute.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show.
Oops.
I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, there we go. Do we have you? Avner, welcome to the show.
Hi, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm sorry. Please pronounce your last name for me so I don't get it wrong here.
Yeah, it's Gvaryahu.
Say it one more time.
Yeah, that was pretty close. Gvaryahu.
Gvaryahu. Okay, great. So, okay, I got it. Gvaryahu. All right, so welcome. Thank you very much for joining us on the show today. The website is breakingthesilence.org.il, and the project is about Protective Edge, the war last summer against Gaza. And you guys have testimonies from how many 60-something soldiers, and it's sort of, it's like the Winter Soldier testimonies from Vietnam and from the Iraq War, everybody, where these members of the IDF talk about the real war as they witnessed it, and in a way that, you know, might tend to cast a little bit of doubt on all those slogans about the IDF being the most moral army in the world. So how many was it? 60? How many soldiers here that you got?
Yeah, so it was actually 70, a little bit less than 70 soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
About a third of them were officers, which is something which is pretty unique for these kinds of reports. We've been around as an organization for over a decade now. So we really started working around the end of the Second Intifada, which was around the year 2000. And the organization started in 2004. So we're really, this June will be our 11th year. And we've been documenting the Israeli occupation from the perspective of the occupier, if you'd like, for all this time. All our work is done by former soldiers. So I myself was actually a paratrooper, and alongside with me in the organization, there's people that served in different infantry units and different battalions, and we all came together in order to, you know, break our silence around this too long military occupation, and that's what we're basically here to do.
All right, so now how difficult was it for you to find soldiers who were willing to talk about what happened last summer?
Well, it definitely wasn't an easy task, and right after the operation was over, we realized that it's a part of our duty, and we understood as an organization it's part of our duty to get you know, a different perspective from the soldiers who were there out there, and we you know, I would say it sort of happened in the same time that we started reaching out to people and people started contacting us. As I said, because we've been around for a while now, we actually met throughout the 11 years we've been around. We met close to 1,000 soldiers. So when we you know, put our heads together and said, okay, how are we going to get the soldiers who were serving, who just finished serving? So of course, the natural thing was to turn to soldiers that have already given testimonies. And that was really the beginning of the process. But there were also soldiers that turned to us. A big part of our work is educational work. So and this is throughout the year. You know, the heart of our work is really gathering testimonies, but we also spend a lot of our efforts educating whoever's really interested to hear about what we heard. So a lot of the people that we met throughout the years that later on joined the military, after serving in Gaza, turned to us. So it's sort of a combination of us reaching out and people, and many soldiers actually felt that there was an urgency, to contact us. And I think that explains the high numbers, and that explains the large number of officers as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, this is just an assumption, but I guess your critics must say that, well, you're cherry picking. You're finding a couple of guys who are willing to say what you want to hear. But what about the rest of the soldiers? Wouldn't they discredit this and say, no way, we only ever kill bad guys, et cetera?
Well, I would say that, I mean, I don't think that claim is, really, credible. But I mean, I would say that what we really managed to show is the tip of the iceberg. And I definitely think that, I can't say everyone agrees with us, but there's definitely many people that understand that we're really only showing the tip of the iceberg. But I mean, what we're really trying to do, and this is a big part of, and it's not an easy task, but we really find it important to express the fact that we're not an organization that's trying to show, you know, the IDF horror picture show. You know, we're not about showing the rotten apples. We're about showing the norms, and this has been our mantra, constantly. We're always about talking about a system and not about individuals. But I think this time around, this operation, it was so clear that the soldiers that chose to speak with us were really just sharing with us their orders. And I think that in that matter, the soldiers that we met were really doing exactly what they were asked to be told. And I think this time around, more than others, the claims that we maybe found a few, if you'd like, rotten apples, just doesn't compute with the testimonies, which constantly go back up to the chain of command and talk about rules of engagement and talk about massive usage of artillery and talk about massive areas of killing zones, and these are things that can only come from the top. There are specific incidences that shout out, but those incidences only talk about the system, and I think that's really where we're trying to put our focus.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well now, so do us a favor then, go through, I guess, if you could, please start with those rules of engagement. Some of this sounds like the Vietnam War, where this is an area where no one is supposed to be. So if they're here, they must be guilty of something. They count as Viet Cong, basically. Go ahead and get them.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, I mean, I don't know enough about Vietnam. I mean, I do know a lot about the various operations and wars that Israel took part in. So I'll leave you with the comparison, which is fine. I would say that when I think and when I compare this operation in Gaza to other operations in Gaza or in the West Bank, we see that we have definitely dramatically changed the way that we're fighting the Palestinians in Gaza or Palestinian guerrilla or terrorist groups in Gaza.
You're saying there's an official change in the rules of engagement.
Yeah, there's definitely a change that we can really start dating it back to the end of the Second Intifada, which, as I mentioned, was around the year 2000, and definitely something that we see very dramatically is the change after the Second Lebanese War, which was around 2006. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you just a small example, and I think this will really relate to the areas that I mentioned or that you mentioned, the areas where basically anyone in them was seen as an enemy. And this is maybe one of the biggest changes we see in the past 10 years, which is artillery. for many years, and this has really been the reality in the West Bank and in Gaza, and we definitely don't have enough time to go back into the whole history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the Israeli occupation, but we really saw both the West Bank and Gaza as areas that are populated with civilians and that we have to deal with resistance from within these environments. In 2005, when Israel disengages from Gaza, we see a very, very dramatic change. And one of the interesting quotations is really around that time, a parliament member from Meretz, which is one of the Israeli parties, which is one of the more liberal left-wing parties, but the parliament member himself was actually a very high-ranking officer in the artillery brigade in his military service. And after 2005, for the first time, does Israel actually point artillery towards the Gaza Strip. Now, for our listeners who aren't aware with what artillery means, I was an infantry soldier or a paratrooper, so I had to learn a little bit about artillery. Artillery is a very inaccurate weapon. It's basically a weapon that you're only supposed to use in a, you know, full-on war, army against army. And even then, it's very problematic. It becomes extremely problematic when you use this kind of weaponry inside one of the most populated areas in the world, which is the Gaza Strip. And this parliament member, once these artillery cannons were pointed on Gaza around 2005, he says, you're basically forcing our soldiers to act in an immoral way. Because basically using artillery means that you know for a fact that you're not going to have any accurate hits. And a shell, an explosive shell of artillery, every point it hits kills everyone in the radius of 50 meters around it and injures everyone in the radius of 150 meters around it, right? When we talk about artillery shells that were shot in this last operation, we're talking about close to 20,000 that were these kinds of shells. Just in comparison, the last time around in Protective Edge, which was a similar operation, Israel shoots much less, only 3,000 of these kinds of weapons. So we definitely see a massive change. And the only way we allow ourselves to actually shoot this kind of weapon is because we declare very big areas inside the Gaza Strip as war zones. We take populated neighborhoods, and we declare these areas as war zones. We throw pamphlets from the air, and a few hours afterwards, we start bombarding the area with artillery. And the soldiers basically enter an area that in their mindset, because there was the pamphlets, and it's already after artillery. And in Hebrew, when we talk about artillery, we basically, the military term is to soften, lirakech, to soften the area before the troops come in. So we basically soften this area with thousands of artillery shells, and soldiers enter these neighborhoods in the pretense that they're entering an area that have no civilians in it. And when you read the testimonies of the soldiers, and I recommend everyone to find, very, very easy to find on our website, the soldiers over and over again talk about the fact that there are no civilians in these areas, or that they're told that there are no civilians in these areas, and that because there are no civilians there, any person they see, they can basically shoot to kill.
Right,
now, contrary to what they were told, right? And this was basically a point which we feel soldiers were basically lied to. So I don't think the soldiers were victims here, but definitely they were lied to because they were told that they're entering areas that there are no civilians there. And when soldiers talk to us over and over and over again, we hear stories of soldiers entering houses in these areas that were already bombarded, right, where soldiers are shooting in every direction, where you have tanks shooting to every place that seems suspicious. And inside these neighborhoods, soldiers enter houses. Sometimes 30, 40 people are there. Women are walking back to their homes to get medicine. Old men. We have a story, an incident of an old man that was shot and killed. Because in these areas, the pretense was you have no civilians, which factually was just not true.
Yeah, that's the same premise of from Vietnam, that Free Fire Zone or Fallujah in 2004 is another good example of that same policy where we just insist there couldn't possibly be civilians. Anyone that you see is a combatant, so treat them as such, even if you can tell with your own lying eyes that it's clearly not a combatant. You go ahead and kill them anyway. That's the policy. And now, you mentioned how there was a big change after Lebanon in 2006. Did these guys talk about the Daia Doctrine, which was named after a neighborhood in Lebanon where supposedly the IDF learned the lesson that it's a good thing sometimes to just raise a whole neighborhood to the ground, and we'll call it the Daia Doctrine now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point, which we definitely put an emphasis on in our analysis as an organization. So we really see the Dahia as a, we call it the Dahia Doctrine, the Dahia Doctrine, as one of those changes that really has brought us to this point. And as you mentioned, really this neighborhood in Beirut, which was basically destroyed to the ground, and this actually became it. Maybe Beirut was one of those points where we really implemented it, but it was a doctrine that officers were taught in officer school for a while. But actually, our current chief of staff, Gadi Eisenkot, is sort of like the poster boy of the Dahia Doctrine, and he was quoted saying, you know, if there'll be a house that shoots at us from a village, the entire village will be destroyed. There's something along those lines, where the idea is a non-proportionate or a disproportionate response to any aggression. and I think that the mindset of this doctrine is because we're in this sort of reality where it's not tank against tank or plane against plane, but it's a very strong military, in this case Israel, versus smaller guerrilla groups, we're never going to have a clear victory. So the only thing we can do is make sure that the next round will be in the latest time as possible. So the stronger blow we give our enemy, the longer it will take him to actually reboot and then retaliate. Now, when you understand that this is the mindset, I think you understand Gaza, because you know there was definitely, and this I'm saying this is I think an important point. There was definitely a real threat on villages in the southern border of Israel. There was definitely a threat, of course, by the missiles or by attack tunnels. And there was a real feeling of fear, and as an Israeli, this is something I can relate to. But I think that we also have the responsibility to talk about, you know, the tools that we are using in order to deal with these threats. And I feel that was totally lacking from the discourse around this last Gaza war, where we definitely, without any doubt, used a disproportionate amount of power. And you know, I mentioned artillery before. I think artillery is definitely one of the best examples of this massive use of power. I mean, alongside almost 35,000 artillery shells, 19,000 of them were the explosive shells, but 35,000 altogether of artillery shells, we have close to 20,000 tank shells which are shot. We have close to 5,000 Air Force missions. And, you know, this is part of the reason that we see this massive, massive destruction. And when you listen to the testimonies of the soldiers, you realize that in many cases, the fire was not shot in order to protect soldiers or to protect civilians, but actually to create massive damage. And it's not only with artillery, but it's also with the tank shells. One of the testimonies we got is from a soldier during his second day in the Gaza Strip. He's sort of the northern part of center north of the Gaza Strip, where he's they're actually wake up in the morning. Their commander asks them, all the tanks, to go up in to form a row, seven tanks, and to aim into a neighborhood called El Bourej. And without any reason, they weren't shot at. They didn't see anyone in the distance. They do what he calls "Good morning, El Bourej," and they basically all the seven tanks shoot into random houses into El Bourej. Now El Bourej was 3 kilometers away of where these tanks were, right? But this story is actually not unique when you hear the other tankers, when you hear the other soldiers on the ground. There was constant fire, and this constant fire was part of the mindset of the definitely part of the mindset of the Dahiya doctrine.
All right, now let me ask you this, Abner. What can you tell me? What have you learned about the attacks on the safe zones? Because as you said, the safe zones basically are what's left when you have to flee from what's now become a free fire zone. They say when they drop the flyers, you're not safe here, go there and you'll be safe there. And so all the civilians flee there. And then as they were complaining at the time, they get bombed when they went to the safe zone just as well as in the free fire zone. And then I guess as a corollary to that same question, would be, what about the attacks on the UN schools? I mean, they kept claiming, well, it's just an accident, but they kept bombing UN schools full of refugees. Did you have testimony that sheds any light on what was going on there?
Yeah, I do. I actually have to say that I think that, and this we heard over and over again from soldiers, there were points and there were places outside of if you like the fire zones or these combat zones where soldiers were ordered, do not shoot schools, do not shoot UN buildings and so on and so forth. And I think I can't say this for a fact because we really don't have accounts of each and every one of the missions, but I think it would be fair to say that every time a school or a UN building was hit, it actually was by accident. Now, but I'm saying that with a grain of salt, because one of the interesting testimonies that we got, and this is actually also in the booklet, was from a soldier that was in charge of, was an officer in one of the artillery corps. And he actually describes one of the debriefings that he got. And in the debriefing, they, you know, the artillery, which is always a little bit in the leg, a little bit in the back of the infantry and the tanks, or a little bit deeper inside the area, or specifically here in the strip, the artillery are always in the back, and they don't have a good picture of what's happening in the front, and they always feel that they're not giving enough protection to the soldiers. And in this briefing, a few of the officers talk about the fact that they feel that they're not really giving the soldiers on the ground enough protection. And one of the most high-ranking officers in that room actually calls a bunch of them up, and when the debriefing ends, he tells them something along the lines of, "Listen, guys, there's a trick." And he explains to them, "This is what we did in Lebanon." And he describes a reality where you have a target that you want to shoot on, right? It could be, and this is, again, depends on the time of the operation, and we hear different things from different soldiers, but it could be, you know, a Hamas gunman, and it could be someone just looking on the roof. It depends. Both scenarios could be seen as a threat. But even if you see, let's say, a gunman and he's shooting the troops. Hamas gunman shooting the IDF troops. And in his perimeter, right, let's say 200 meters from him, there is a UN school. The rules of the artillery are you're not allowed to shoot the gunman if he's too close to a school. And if you'll actually put into the GPS at specific point that you want to shoot in, you won't get permission. So this high-ranking officer says, I have a trick for you guys. The point that you ask for shouldn't be 200 meters away from the school. It should actually be 400 meters from the school. So you double the distance. Now, artillery is a very inaccurate weapon. So this officer says, after you ask for 400 meters, the only thing you have to do is turn your barrel 200 meters to the right. So to make a long story short, I really don't think, and this is again from our testimonies, that there wasn't a deliberate attempt to hit schools. But, and this is a very important but, there were definitely also cases that we know of, or that we know that potentially happened, that we did not do whatever we can to make sure we wouldn't hit schools. And this is contrary to what we said.
Mm-hmm. But what about the contradiction between, hey, run here to the safe zone and then people getting bombed in the safe zones? Was that overblown or was there a reason for that? Do you know?
Yeah. So I think one of the things we hear, and this is also something that was a lot in the media, is what was called the knock on the roof. Maybe you heard of this practice. Uh-huh. Knock on the roof basically at least this is what we were told in the Israeli media. This is sort of a way to protect Palestinians living in who are in houses, right? We'll have this small missile that will not, you know, that will hit the roof, and then people inside the house will know that there'll be a few moments later, right? There'll be a bigger bomb that will come and destroy the house. And this was sort of sold to the Israeli public. I don't know how it was seen around the world, but definitely sold to the Israeli public as sort of a humanitarian action, because this way we save lives. And I think one of the examples to show how this is absurd, this idea, is that we meet soldiers that were actually not on the ground, but were in what are called attack cells. You know, the soldiers are sitting inside the war rooms and giving the okay for the Air Force. And these attack cells get multiple perspectives. It could be intelligence, it could be information from the ground, it could be information from the air, and they eventually have to make up their mind and say, is it okay to attack this house or this individual? And one of the things that we hear, for example, is that most of the Air Force attacks or strikes were actually deeper into the strip. So not inside the areas that the soldiers were at, but actually inside the place that we told Palestinians that they should be evicted to, right? So, for example, we know that Palestinians were evicted from the neighborhood of Beit Lahia or Beit Hanun and were told to go into the refugee camp of Jabalia or to the city of Jabalia. But we also know that there were airstrikes inside Jabalia. So one of the things we hear from these attack cells about this knock on the roof is that in many cases, there were these knock on the roofs, but sometimes there was half a minute or a minute from the knock on the roof to the actual bomb. And the testifier, the soldier, tells us maybe a Hamas member or Islamic Jihad member is fast enough to run in this split second and to go into a tunnel. But the grandmother on the fifth floor, the fourth floor, she won't make it, right? So this is one understanding why there were these civilian casualties. Another understanding that we get is that the IDF actually does have the capacity to know in accuracy how many people are in each house. We don't know how. We're not exactly sure what the methods are, but we hear this from soldiers. And we also know that this method was not always carried out. So, for example, if you have an airstrike that you want to carry out in Jabalia, which is a neighborhood that you evicted Palestinians into, right? And you now have this knock on the roof, right? And you only have an idea of how many people are in the house because your intelligence is pretty old. It could be a month old, 2 months old, sometimes a year old. So it says in your information, it says in this house you have 20 people living. But now you just had entire neighborhoods flee into Jabalia. So maybe each house has double the number. This is information the Air Force doesn't have. So I think it's much more about the fact that we are now in, you know, the way we conduct our wars with in Gaza is that we will, you know, and I really think this is true. I don't think that soldiers, and this is from meeting many soldiers and reading the testimonies, soldiers did not wake up in the morning with the urge to kill as many Palestinians as possible. I think this was not the case. But I think that there definitely was, in many cases, indiscriminate fire. And I think that there were, in many cases, realities where we did not do whatever we can in order to save innocent lives. And I think in the end of the day, when we look at the numbers, if we look at the numbers of, you know, the innocent civilians who were killed, we look at the numbers of the children that were killed, I really don't think that there was, you know, like we hear in various wars or specifically like Vietnam, you know, the death toll. And I don't think that was the case. But I do think that there was a disproportionate use of power and definitely this idea that we will do whatever we need, many times not asking ourselves or moral questions in order to protect the soldiers, also at the expense of innocent Palestinians.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it seems, again, like you're talking about with the free fire zones and this kind of thing, and we see this, you know, from a lot of different wars where enemy gets defined down and rationalizations, you know, get stretched in order to include people who are killed. We see this with the drone strike too, where if they kill the fighting aged male with a drone, well, he must have had it coming unless you can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt he was innocent after he's dead anyway, and it doesn't matter. And that's, you know, and they call that the just laws of war too, but.
Yeah, there's actually one of the testimonies, which I think is really along those lines, is a story in the south part of the Gaza Strip of two women that are walking, you know, between 500 meters, 700 meters from the troops. So they're definitely not at risk. And our testifier tells us this whole story where it's noon and they see these two women and there's some sort of fear. Maybe they're lookouts or maybe, you know, they're in this zone. So they go up to their commander on the radio and the commander orders an airstrike. And the airstrike kills these two women. Now, the guy who talks to us, he says, I felt this is bullshit. So he actually makes a point to know what they found on these two women. So they, you know, there's two tanks that they go up and check what these two women have on them. And they don't find anything on these women, not a weapon or even a walkie-talkie. And they find two cell phones on them. And the testifier says, it's a joke. Who doesn't walk around today with a cell phone? So he goes eventually to the what is called like the war room, where they write down all the information about people who were killed and you know, an enemy that was successfully stopped or destroyed or whatnot, and he realizes that these two women are actually written down as terrorists, even though nothing was found on them. And this is something that we hear more and more, this idea of how we took this, what used to be this idea of targeted assassination, where you have a specific individual and you build a whole profile on him, and you know, he's the biggest bad guy that you can find, and then you assassinate him. And we hear this from other soldiers as well, is that we basically took this idea and turned it on the head. We kill someone, and like you said, later on we build the entire file.
Right. Now, so for Americans, we live in a big old country here. I live in Texas, and it's a big old country all by itself. But could you explain to people in a way where you think they might be able to really get their head around just what the Gaza Strip even is, how big it is, how many people are crammed in there, and just what a canned hunt this entire exercise is in terms of who versus who?
Yeah, so when we're talking about the Gaza Strip, we're talking about one of the most densely populated areas in the world, in an area which is extremely, extremely small. Sadly, I don't know what the best comparison in the U.S. would be, but we are talking about a very narrow strip. Again, we use the metric system. I should have thought about that, but we're talking about the length of a little bit more than 30 kilometers, which is pretty short. You know, it's sort of you can pass all the strip from north to south in about more or less half an hour, 40 minutes. That's north to south. East to west, it's very, very narrow. We're talking about in some areas 5 kilometers, you know, which is a 5 minute car ride. And in some areas, which is a little bit wider, 12 kilometers. So we're talking about a very, very small area with about 1.8 million Palestinians, more or less. There's different numbers it depends who you ask, and demographics is always a very politicized point, 1.2, 1.8, it really depends. But there are a variety of very important organizations, both Israeli and Palestinians and international, that deal with these issues. And I think Gaza is a very important point. I have to say that it's one of those topics which is that there's definitely not an easy solution on the table. It's definitely one of those things that I feel that as Israelis, even Israelis who tend to support some sort of resolution or tend to support some sort of positive change, are very confused about. For obvious reasons. I mean, I think that Hamas controlling the Strip are not making the lives easier for Palestinians living there. Definitely not making it easier for the Palestinian Authority. I think that without diving into that whole issue, it's something we can't ignore. And I think that the way we Israel, when I talk about Israel, I talk about myself, even with the criticism I have to my military and the actions of my government. I talk about, the change I want to see in my country. We can't ignore Gaza. We have to think of a different way that we're going to be moving forward, because the only thing that I can promise you without any doubt, and this is something that Israeli politicians from across the board will all agree upon, is that there's going to be another operation. There's going to be another war. And the former chief of staff, who just spoke in the convention last week, he said the next round is going to be much worse. So everyone knows this is about to come. And the only way we know how to converse with our neighbors, if we'd like it or not, is through the barrel of our gun, or with bigger numbers of artillery. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do as an organization, and this is, you know, us as former Israelis, this is us, former soldiers and current Israelis that want to continue to live in this place, is that we have to, you know, think of a different route. You know, we have to think of a different way that we can have some sort of relationship and move forward from these terrible, terrible operations where, dozens of Israelis were killed, dozens of Israeli soldiers were killed, and thousands of Palestinians lost their lives. And this is just something that we find to be devastating.
All right, everybody. That is Avner Gavaryahu. I'm sorry. I'm going to get that right.
That was great.
Avner Gavaryahu. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
It's very important work that you're doing there. That's breakingthesilence.org.il. Breakingthesilence.org.il. And just go and read dozens and dozens and dozens of firsthand
Winter Soldier type testimonies from IDF soldiers and officers who participated in the last war. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back. So that worked out good, man. A little bit of technical difficulty at the beginning, but got a great interview out of Avner Gavaryahu. Avner Gavaryahu. Yeah, he's great, man. I wrote him on the list. I can't say it right, but I can spell it. He's on the list for getting back on the show in the future if I can. He was great. All right, now, man, I had all kinds of news I wanted to cover for you here. I wanted to talk more about that Hirsch thing, but I'll tell you what, I'll just interview him tomorrow the next day for you, and then we'll take care of that then. But now I want to play this interview that I did with Patrick L. Smith, recorded on Saturday for the KPFK show on Sunday, but it didn't get played there, so now it's getting played here.
For Pacifica Radio, May 10th, 2015, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio.
All right, y'all, this is Anti-War Radio. I'm your host, Scott Horton, here every Sunday morning from 8:30 to 9 on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. You can find my full interview archive, more than 3,500 of them now, going back to 2003, at scotthorton.org. And you can follow me on Twitter, if you dare, at Scott Horton Show. Our guest this morning is Patrick L. Smith. He's the best writer at Salon.com. And is the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. He was the International Herald Tribune's bureau chief in Hong Kong and then Tokyo from 1985 to 1992. His latest piece is The Spotlight this weekend at antiwar.com. The New York Times does its government's bidding. Here's what you're not being told about U.S. troops in Ukraine. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you?
I'm well, Scott. Thank you.
Very happy to have you back on the show here, and a very important article, and I sure am glad you're writing, because as you know, you're one of one handful of writers in America who's keeping up with the story of what's really going on in Ukraine and how Uncle Sam, if you want to call him that, got us into this mess. But first of all, today's VE Day, or I guess yesterday was VE Day, and they're doing a big celebration in Russia, and all the Western leaders are refusing to attend.
And right. I'm glad you began with that remark, Scott. This really has to count as an abominable disgrace. I don't want to overstate the case, but I don't think it's possible to overstate it. The Russians gave 27 million people to the defeat of the Nazis. And we are willing to dispense with that because we are having political disputes with them in the year 2015 that have nothing to do with it. Talk about the erasing of memory. We are, it's just, let's just say, unjust at the very minimum and unappreciative.
I've read you, Patrick, and a few others remarking that nobody ever talked about Khrushchev, or never mind Uncle Joe Stalin, but Khrushchev and Andropov and the rest of the Soviet dictators during the bad old days of the USSR. The Americans never talked about them the way that they talk about Putin.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? In a column long back, I counted up. Not since Stalin has anybody been been this thoroughly run into the ground. The common word is demonized, and it's good enough. And Stalin, only after his Uncle Joe days were over, right? Why? Well, I did a long interview with Stephen Cohen, the Russianist, the other week, and he pointed out, I thought very astutely, demonizing Russia is a substitute for policy, right? We don't know what else to do, and it's a substitute for analysis. We don't have a policy over there other than to aggress as far as close to the Russian border as we can. And what beyond that? I haven't heard a word as to what's supposed to happen then. I as I said in my column this past week, the one that got me on your show, and admittedly it was quite a heated column, we are really playing with fire here now. Two nuclear powers coming this close to personnel contact. It's just thoughtless. Shocking.
Well, and see, that's the thing of it too, right? Is that the worst case scenario is the extinction of mankind in a full scale thermonuclear exchange or this kind of thing. And yet,
right,
there's not too much gray area between sending troops to train Ukraine's army and screw around and maybe cause a war and total war. I mean, if there's a war, it's going to include H-bombs. There's no way for America to fight Russia and keep it conventional in any sense.
Well, I'll go with the verb could, right? And could is awful enough, right? I think I would like to say to listeners, we're talking about several hundred people, several hundred Americans in uniform, at least several hundred announced, acknowledged. We don't know beyond that. And we can't sensibly have these sorts of conversations, Scott, on the assumption that we know everything. We really mustn't. So we have an acknowledged several hundred. All right, it's a small number. But look, as I encourage readers all the time, think with history. Don't forget how these things started in the past. Vietnam started with several hundred. Imagine back in the very early 50s, anybody saying this will end with 4 million Vietnamese dead and 58,000 Americans. Who would have one would have thought they were crazy, right? The Iraq War, look what it ballooned into. The pattern is very plain, and the pattern is what causes me to be so disturbed.
Mm-hmm. Well, and someone might get the impression, as you write in this article, that, well, it must not be that big of a deal, because when the New York Times mentions it at all, of course, they just blame everything on Russia, and they never give the real context, but they don't even pay that much attention to the story. And so, hey, it's just another training exercise in just another country. America trains armies all over the world. What difference does
right.
it make is what the
look,
average person might think about this.
Right. Look, when President Obama sent several hundred Americans back to Iraq as advisors sometime last year, correct? Last summer? Okay. That was page A1 in the New York Times. We all remember that. That was a very big deal. We now send several hundred advisors, trainers, what have you, to in proximity of Russia's western border, which has been historically exceedingly sensitive border, and it's not news. It has been mentioned because it's the elephant in the living room. It has to be mentioned, mm-hmm. right? True. But tiny little, the first Time story was on an inside page, more or less a brief with a byline.
All right, so that's Patrick L. Smith, writer for Salon.com. He needs to find a better place to write, but he writes great stuff, and he's really good on Ukraine, as you can tell. We'll be right back with more of that interview in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation.
And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Again, Patrick L. Smith.
And I've spoken to any number of very informed friends since that column came out, and they say, gee, I didn't know. Well, that's the idea. We didn't know, right? I can't forgive the paper for that.
All right, now, so if we could back up a little bit.
Sure.
Patrick, again, it's Patrick L. Smith, great writer at Salon.com. What's Ukraine to Russia anyway?
It is, let's say, civilizationally important. All right. Russian, what do we want to call it, heritage culture, is intimately connected with Kiev and extends far back into history. More recently, so there's language, there's culture, there's history, there's shared traditions, there's familial ties. Remember when things went haywire in eastern Ukraine and a million people were displaced, you won't read this, but the very great majority of them went back to Russia, right? That ought to tell us something, all right, about the intimacy of this relationship. Now, we have to address the geopolitics of it too, surely. All right. My position on this is as follows. Spheres of influence are 19th century technologies. They were never very attractive. During the colonial era, when they would have, in many people's minds, reached their sort of high point, they were pretty ugly. Of course, we all know that. But my view is, no, that's not when spheres of influence came fully into their own. The Cold War was basically the division of the planet into spheres of influence. Now, these are undesirable concepts. I call it just a bad, outdated technology. So my view is we must, but they are realities, especially given the eastern advance of NATO and other such things, right? And in my view, the Cold War never really ended. I've said that numerous times. So what do we do in a sensible policy design? We must observe spheres of influence without honoring them. Everybody knows they are not attractive, and it's our job in the 21st century to ditch them. But we haven't yet. As numerous people say, reverse this situation and think just for a second what would happen. We would have perhaps the Russians active in the Yucatan Peninsula, right? And we go back a mere half a century to the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's no ambiguity about this, right? And so we have deep historical cultural ties, and then we have more recently the really regrettable East-West tensions and our failure in the 21st century to advance beyond these. They are realities. Mm-hmm. One more remark, Scott, if sure. I may. Look, the Times coverage is one does have to say purposefully misleading at this point, and that's why my ire was stirred in that last column such that it was. Look, the trainers arrived in mid-April. We had a Pentagon announcement, I think, the 16th of April. It's in the record. A week or two later, we had a report from Washington, the State Department, the inimitable Marie Harf, the State Department, the hack who does the State Department's announcements, saying the Russians are amassing troops again on their border. Putin is, of course, amassing troops on his western border. All right. And he said 2 weeks ago that the presence of our trainers would destabilize the situation. Here's the failure. No causality was ever suggested in the news coverage. We are being led to think that the presence of these troops there should have absolutely no bearing on Moscow's thinking. It's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. And it's an abandonment of responsibility, speaking as a professional practitioner, for the Times to put this stuff across as sort of wide-eyed innocence, right? We decline. This is an old habit in Washington, and it runs all through our media coverage of these sort of situations. Absolutely allergic to notions of causality. Why did this happen? How did A, B, and C line up? You never get it, Scott.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is an important point that you make, too, about how it's not Russia or Moscow or the Kremlin. It's Putin does this and Putin
right.
does that. Personalizing everything onto him makes it
right.
where anything we do to them is okay. And we saw the same thing from, you know, Noriega to Koresh to Hussein, that you can kill whoever might be around them if you just demonize the one guy enough or get away with whatever murder.
It's the manipulation of consciousness. It's the manipulation of our awareness. It is the manipulation of our way of thinking about these things. And you get just venomous hatred from ordinary Americans who ought to know better, but they have been, this has been sort of drummed into them. I mean, media are exceedingly powerful. Every advertising executive from Edward Bernays onward can tell you that. You can get people to think whatever you want them to think. And this is dangerous. This is a component of our danger in that we are so vastly uninformed. Go to the European press and you get an entirely different accounting of these things. I find it a bit frightening that 320 million Americans can be kept this thoroughly in the dark on these matters. It's not healthy.
Right. Okay, now, so again, we're talking with Patrick L. Smith from Salon.com. The article is New York Times Does Its Government's Bidding. Here's what you're not being told about U.S. troops in Ukraine. So let me ask, what are these guys thinking about expanding NATO? You know, John Mearsheimer wrote in Foreign Affairs that, you know, great job with your academic exercise about just how neat and nice it's going to be to expand the EU and NATO. On top of that, the military alliance that includes America all the way to Russia's borders. You said it wouldn't anger the Russians, and look, now it did. But so what is the point of this thing? I mean, I used to think that they would bring in the Russians. They had the Russian NATO Council and stuff. They would end up bringing the Russians in and then sell them on our missile defense and whatever and make the kind of one world army of the North or this kind of thing. Never did that. But they can't possibly, Patrick, really think that they're going to get a regime change in Russia or break Russia apart into pieces without having a nuclear war first. And so what in the hell do they think they're doing? Seriously.
When hyper-rationality tips into irrationality, okay? In my view, Putin's rise in Russia altered thinking in Washington very profoundly. After the Soviet Union ended and then was dismembered by Yeltsin. All the wealth distributed to oligarchs and so forth. It became clear Putin inherited a catastrophic domestic situation, right? And it had become clear by then that the partnership proffered at the end of the Cold War didn't really mean an equal partnership. It meant now...
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Now that we have won the Cold War, a mistaken concept to begin with, you may come along with us and follow in our footsteps, right? You will have a free market economy, and you will be grateful for it. And in these sorts of ways, you will cooperate as a very prominent Russian essayist, poet, actually, wrote to Havel in Prague at this time. All the Indians are now supposed to imitate the cowboys. That was the concept. And Putin has made it clear that he's not interested in that. And I think rightfully so. One can find all manner of things wrong with Putin's style of government and administration, fine. They don't really, you have your secondary contradiction and your primary contradiction, okay? His treatment of the press, gay rights, and so on and so forth, that doesn't have to do with what we're talking about now. What we're talking about now is a leader who insists that no, you may not extend neoliberal economics and NATO up to our border. And no, you are not welcome to threaten the regime, what we are attempting to do here in Moscow, right? That's my view of Putin in his primary manifestation now. The domestic stuff is not our business. That's for Russians to address, right? Mm-hmm. That's my response to this query.
Now, so, but I wonder whether you think, and I've heard this analogy made a couple of different ways, but what about the idea that right now this is Weimar Russia, despite what Hillary Clinton says about Putin being Hitler? You know, hey, this guy could die of cancer in 6 months or something. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
And then who comes after him? Or maybe there's, remember he went on vacation with his girlfriend for a week and everybody freaked out like there was some kind of coup? Well,
ridiculous.
What if there was? And what if people far to the right of Putin come next?
Right. It's a corollary to your previous question, and I'm glad you returned to it in this way. We don't have a forward plan, all right? We've done this over and over and over again. We didn't have a forward plan when we knocked over Saddam Hussein. And damn it, it's pretty hard to make Saddam Hussein look good. But we managed to do so over the next 10 years, didn't we? We don't have a forward plan for any kind of post-Putin regime change whatsoever. And most saliently, Scott, we are deluded in the assumption that we can win this Ukraine crisis, that we can resolve it our way. There is no way under the sun that Moscow is going to tolerate a Western success in Ukraine, the installation of NATO facilities and so forth. Just forget it. They will go to the mat on this. And we just don't seem to get that. Mm-hmm. We just don't seem to get that. They will go all the way, just as we would if a reverse situation were to occur in our hemisphere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in your article here at Salon.com, you talk about the sensitive history. I think you mentioned before in the interview, too, the sensitive history of Ukraine and Russia, in the sense that not just are they very close countries in terms of geography and longtime history going back, America to Canada or America to Mexico, that kind of thing.
Right.
But they've been invaded by way of Ukraine more times than anybody can count, I guess.
Yes. You know, it's again, this border with Europe, the Europe, let's say, the Europe-facing border is very, very sensitive real estate. Why policy thinkers cannot factor this in to their considerations is absolutely beyond me. Is it some kind of sign of weakness to say, this justly or unjustly is a problem? We better observe the sensitivities. We're just not there. We are in a certain way deluded as to our own unchallengeable power, right? We're going to get a bloody nose here. I said a year ago, we will retreat on Ukraine one way or another, and I hope we are forced to sooner rather than later. There is a perfectly good solution in Ukraine, and you don't have to have left, right, or center politics to understand its virtue. The country's natural divisions, its location between East and West, are perfect for a federalized Ukraine. There is only one thing wrong with that idea. Vladimir Putin thinks it's sensible, too.
Yeah. So, in other words, they could work it out, and they don't want that. They prefer
they
crisis.
They could work it out in less than a week. And one of the hidden aspects of the current agenda, Scott, make no mistake, the Germans and the French and others in Europe are very eager for a negotiated settlement of the kind I just described. Mm-hmm. That's why there were ceasefire talks in Minsk twice. We are now living in what we call Minsk 2, an imperfect ceasefire, but the best we got right now.
Well, now,
right?
So back to the beginning then, Patrick, is it the case that the reason the Americans are sending weapons and trucks and all this military gear and money and special forces to train their National Guard, who, I'm sorry, we didn't have time to get to the fact that we're training their National Guard, not their army, but their National Guard, who are at least in great measure a bunch of Nazis. Are they doing Minsk, too? Is that the purpose of this?
Yes, that's what I was about to say. The hidden, one hidden purpose of these troops there is to... It is an act of resistance against European efforts for a negotiated settlement. We do not want a negotiated settlement. We do not want a compromise. We don't understand that word. It's not in our vocabulary. We were very upset with Minsk, too. Please note, listeners, we weren't invited for a very good reason. It was structured with Putin's people. Well, Putin himself was right there. Mm-hmm. This was done. This is what people are working toward. And at this moment, we send troops in to train. Think it over. Our fronts in this conflict are two. One is with Russia, and the other, more quietly, is with Chancellor Merkel's efforts toward a negotiated settlement.
Right. Well, and, you know, she even came to America first, right? And read Obama the Riot Act, said, stay out of this. I'm going to make this peace deal. Did I read that right?
Yes, you did. Get the chronology correct. It's a little micro, but I'll do my best. There was an announcement in Washington. Let's vote to send weapons to Ukraine. The Europeans quaked. All right, that was on a Monday. Secretary of State Kerry announced instantly he's going to Kiev. He was due to arrive that Thursday. All right. It was plain what he was going to discuss. That Wednesday, Chancellor Merkel called François Hollande in Paris and said, get yourself a plane ticket. We're going to Kiev and we're going on from there to Moscow. A completely improvised trip. And that was when Minsk II was planned and subsequently signed. And so at that point, Merkel had said to the Americans, absolutely no on the weaponry. Absolutely no. We were forced to observe that. We have been to date. And what's the next move? Trainers. Okay, no weaponry, but trainers.
And plenty of trucks and other military equipment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the non-lethal bit, mm-hmm. right? Goggles and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, although dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of trucks, that can make a bit of a difference on the battlefield. It's not nothing.
Yeah, I'm right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, I hate to do this to you, Patrick, but I got to end this interview soon, and I'm going to end it on a point made by Henry Kissinger, for crying out loud, he said, yeah. Look at the timing of what all happened here.
Oh, no, you don't get to hear the very end of the interview, everybody. That's it for the show today. Check out that archive. It'll be on Scotthorton.org tonight or later or something.